Okay, we are on. So we're discussing now the issue of Heter Iska. I figured that maybe we'll devote one or two chaburis to this subject. I'm thinking maybe two chaburis. We'll see if people are still interested after this week. So we'll discuss the idea of what Heter Iska is all about. And I want to discuss today the case of Quicken Loans, the Quicken Loans story. Some of you may be familiar. There's a lending institution known as Quicken Loans. They originate many, many mortgages, the vast majority of which, or pretty much all of which, are very soon thereafter sold off to another mortgage company. And it was discovered a number of years ago that Quicken Loans, which extends loans to lots of people, including Jewish people, is a company which is primarily owned by a Jewish person. It's primarily owned by a Jewish person. And we have a prohibition of ribbis. The Torah describes in a number of different places, in Vayikra and Dvarim, that there is a prohibition for one Jew to loan money to another Jew with interest. That's called ribbis. It's called the neshech v'sabis, that you're not allowed to loan your money in such a fashion that the borrower is going to be required to pay a premium for the fact that he gets the use of the money for an extended period of time. That's called kol agar nutter aser, that any agar, any payment for nutter, for the fact that the malvid, the lender, waits a period of time for the money to be repaid by the borrower, that's a schar agar nutter. You're charging money agar nutter for the waiting period is aser. That is the Torah's prohibition of ribbis. We have another principle of ribbis as well. The other principle that the Gemara tells us about is lo aser Torah ela ribbis haba milo v'lamalveh. The only prohibited ribbis, the only prohibited is interest, is if it is money which is paid from a borrower, meaning somebody that we can identify as a Jewish borrower, and it goes to the malveh, it goes to a Jewish lender. So if I have a situation where either the borrower or the lender is not Jewish, so then there is no prohibition of ribbis. This is strictly a special favor that's supposed to be done by co-religionists, that Jews are supposed to extend the chesed to their fellow Jews, that they're not supposed to charge money with ribbis. So this presents a problem to some degree in the commercial world, because in the commercial world, the way that things very often operate is that the way the loans are extended is that the lender expects to receive a premium on the loan and to receive interest in return. So if we're going to identify both the lender and the borrower as Jewish, that's going to be ribbis haba milove lemalve. If it is in fact an agar nutter, if it is a loan transaction, it's going to be a prohibition of ribbis deraisa. We can discuss all kinds of different configurations and permutations of ribbis, with certain types of interest that is prohibited on a Torah level, certain types of ribbis that is prohibited only on a rabbinic level. Like, let's say, for example, if I sell some merchandise to you, and the price of the merchandise is $100. It's not a loan, it's a sale. But you say, I don't have the money right now, I want to pay back on credit. And I say, oh, if you're going to pay back on credit, so then you will pay $10 a month for 12 months. You'll pay me $120. So there too, I'm charging interest, but it's not interest in the context of a loan. It's interest in the context of a sale of merchandise. So that is only ribbis d'rabbanan. That's only rabbinically prohibited ribbis as opposed to Torah prohibited ribbis. Similarly, if I loan to you eggs and I tell you I'm loaning to you 12 eggs and I want you to return to me 12 eggs. But at the time that I loan you the 12 eggs are worth $10, and at the time that you return to me the 12 eggs, they are worth $12. So that also is a rabbinically prohibited form of ribbis. It's not prohibited on a Torah level, because on a Torah level, I loan you 12 eggs and you return to me 12 eggs. So we say, basame kara is linen. We look at what was the reality at the time that I loaned it to you. It was only 12 eggs and you returned to me 12 eggs. But on a drabbanan level, we say that since the price of the eggs is greater when you returned it, so that's rabbinically prohibited interest.
But the price is always changing. I can never return to you what I took for you.
There are times that we will permit eggs for eggs. Like, for example, if the borrower already owns certain eggs, or there is a market price for eggs at the time of the loan, so then we'll allow this type of transaction. But we're not going into that kind of level of detail. Okay, let's assume that we don't have the exceptions applicable in a given case. That would be rabbinically prohibited interest. That's called sa'a b'sa'a. Yes?
But you said that Quicken sells the loans, so money wouldn't change hands from the borrower. He would get their profit from whoever they sold the loans to.
So we're going to get to that. You know, they are quickened, but we can't be that quick. We have to go methodically in terms of how we're going to describe it, this situation, what the problem was, what the potential solution is. So since I said that we're speaking about heter iska, we should speak about what is this idea of heter iska. Is this like some sort of magic pixie dust that we just spray on a ribbis transaction? We say, okay, here's the heter iska pixie dust that we're going to spray, and now any transaction which otherwise would have been ribbis, otherwise would have been prohibited, now becomes permitted. What's this idea of heter iska? Because you often find this, that two people are about to enter into a ribbis bearing loan, and they say, oh, let's do a heter iska, so then everything is going to become mutter. What is it about the heter iska that makes everything permissible? So the Gemara doesn't talk about heter iska per se. The Gemara just talks about iska. What is iska? Iska is a joint venture transaction between a person who provides funds and an individual who manages the funds. We'll call the person who provides the funds the investor, and the person who manages the funds the manager. And in an iska transaction, the investor gives a certain amount of money, let's say it's $100, and the investor says that I am giving this money to the managing party to manage the funds. And I will share in the profits and I will share in the losses of this investment. But the investing party wants a little bit of assurance that they're not going to lose their shirt, they're not going to lose their entire investment. So they stipulate as follows. They stipulate that of this $100, half of it is going to be a loan, and half of it is going to be an investment. It's a pikadon. It is money that is being stored with the managing partner for the managing partner to invest. And therefore, on $50, the investment part, the investor could lose his shirt, he could lose the entirety of the $50. But with respect to the loan portion, that one half that's a loan, the investor is guaranteed that he's going to get a return. However, he can't charge interest. The investor can't charge interest on the half part, which is a loan. He can't charge interest. He's guaranteed of his return of $50. But if there's a profit, then he's not allowed to receive any of that profit because that would be interest, because this is a loan. You can't take money on a loan. What you have to give up in return for the guaranteed return is that you're not allowed to take interest. When is it that you're allowed to take a profit share? When it is a pure investment where the person who's investing the funds shares to lose as easily as he can gain. So therefore, he says to the manager, you're going to invest half of the funds as a pikadon, and I will receive any profit on that half that is generated, but if it's lost, so I will bear the loss with respect to that amount. Now, what benefit does the person who's receiving the funds get in return for investing the funds? Well, he's going to have to return the 50%, $50, which is the loan portion, no matter what. The other $50, so if it's he loses it, so because the investment goes sour, he's not going to have to repay that $50. But if there is a profit which is earned on it, so he'll return the money with the profit to the lender. So we say that we're a little bit afraid that maybe the person who's investing the funds is only investing the funds, only agreeing to engage in this investment because he received a loan. Because after all, half of the money is a loan. So in order to afford to justify this arrangement, we say that the lender has to pay a little bit of money for in return for the manager investing the funds, just so that it not look that this is basically a ribbis agreement where the manager is saying, well, because you're giving me $50 for a loan, so I'm agreeing to invest the other $50. So we say, no, that we're going to pay something. Now, that payment could be $1. Or the way that it could be arranged is as follows, where the investor and the manager can reach the following agreement, where the investor says, look, if there is a profit in the investment, so instead of sharing the profits 50-50, the investor says, you're doing all the work, I'll take 45%, you take 55%. And if it's a loss, so then I will share in the losses entirely. That there's a little bit extra that's given to the manager of the funds to sweeten the deal as an incentive for him to manage the funds and to invest the funds so that it shouldn't look like he's doing it in return for the loan. That's the iska, the classic iska, which is described in the Gemara. Okay, that's the iska transaction. So some of the later day authorities came up with the idea, this is like the generation after the Shulchan Aruch. You won't find this in the Shulchan Aruch or the Ramah, because this is the generation after the Shulchan Aruch and the Ramah. There was the Maharam and Victor Mikrakow came up with this great idea that we're going to allow for a Ribbis transaction to be converted into an Iska transaction. Now, if you converted it into an ISCA transaction, what that would basically mean is that the investor exposes himself that he could lose up to 50% of the investment. But if there's a profit, so then he'll be able to receive the profit. So what happens, practically speaking, the recipient of the funds, the manager of the funds, will take, say, the full $100. The $50, which is a loan, he's going to invest on his own behalf. He gets to keep, you know, whatever profits are generated from that, because he's not going to pay a premium on that amount. That would be Ribbis. And he invests the other 50%, the other $50, on behalf of the investor. So if there is a profit, the profit gets split 50-50. If there's a loss, it gets split 50-50. And maybe he gets a dollar for his efforts, or gives a little bit extra profit, or the investor bears a little bit extra loss in the event that there's a loss, in order that the manager is being paid something. So you'll say, well, that doesn't solve anything. If the lender really wants to be guaranteed an interest return, he's not going to be guaranteed an interest return. At best, he's guaranteed that he's not going to lose his full investment, but he's certainly not guaranteed that he's going to receive back the full investment, and he's definitely not guaranteed that he's going to receive a Ribbis premium. A premium, it all depends on how well the investment is going to do. So there was an idea that was floated by the Trumas Hadeshin. Trumas Hadeshin was a later day Rishon from Austria, of Rav Israel Isserlein. So he had a certain idea in a totally different context that we're not going to go into right now. And it had to do with the rental of money, you know, because you can rent things. I can rent the shovel to you, and you have to return the shovel to me, plus you have to pay me money. That sounds like interest. But it's not interest, because I'm bearing, as the person giving you the shovel, I'm bearing a certain amount of liability as well, because the shovel is going to get worn out a little bit. The shovel is going to get worn out a little bit. And also, in the event that some terrible accident happens to the shovel, since it's a skirus, a rental transaction, so then if you say, oh, the shovel got run over by a truck, whatever it is that happens to shovels, you are not liable to return it to me. So therefore, it's not guaranteed that I'm going to receive the shovel plus my rental fee. So therefore, we say that's not a prohibition of Ribbis. Whenever we have a rental type of situation, your standard type of rental situation. But one thing you can't rent is money, because after all, that's the whole idea of agur nutter. Agur nutter means that I'm collecting money from renting money. I'm not allowed to do that. That is the definition of the prohibition of Ribbis. So Trumas Hadeshin had certain ideas where he said, well, maybe if the person who is renting out the money bears a significant amount of the liability, namely where even if the money, let's say, is going to get stolen or the money is going to get lost, where normally we say that if I am the renter, so I have responsibility if the item gets stolen or lost. So let's say the person who is the owner of the object says, no, I'll bear that liability. And I will bear the liability also if an accident occurs to it as well. And even if there's pshia, even if there's negligence on the part of the renter, he's not going to have liability towards me. Once you have this augmented amount of responsibility and liability that has been assumed by the owner, that he's going to assume liability not only if there's an onus, but even if there's neighbor vaved, or even if there's pshia, unless the person who is renting the money is mazik mamish, that he takes the money and he shoots it with a gun or something like that. So then in such a case, the Trumas Hadeshin thinks that there's room to be lenient, and he throws in a few other considerations that would permit the person who is receiving this rental of money to be able to pay a premium to the lender. And he says, you can stipulate that in the event that there is an actual mazik, where a person who's renting the money would actually shoot the money, and that's the reason why it can't be returned. And it's kind of like a funny case, because money is fungible, it gets spent, you know, so what does it mean you're shooting the money? But, you know, whatever. This is what he comes up with, person who is renting out the money can say, I don't believe you that you didn't shoot it. I don't believe you that that you didn't do something to damage the money in the event that the money is, that the, that the person wants to get out of it, and you would have to take bring witnesses to prove that this didn't happen, and the witnesses have to be the rabbi of the synagogue and the chazan, and then the cantor of the synagogue, and typically the rabbi and the chazan didn't know what was going on in terms of people's business affairs. So if you want to say this happened, you have to, you know, bring the rabbi and the chazan, and if you don't bring the rabbi and the chazan, I'm not going to believe you, and you'll just have to pay me back and pay back the rental fee. Therefore, you're not going to be off the hook. So the Truma Sedeshin's idea was completely rejected. We never allow the rental of money. You know when we allow the rental of money? If let's say that you have like a special, very valuable coin, it's like the first dollar bill that was ever given out by the Lubavitcher Rebbe, and I want to impress people who are coming to a parlor meeting in my house, and I want to show them the first dollar bill of the Lubavitcher Rebbe, so I rent it from you, and I pay you money to rent it from you. So that would be okay. In such a situation, it's not being rented out for milvah lehotzanin, for purposes of being spent on anything. That's a different story. But generally speaking, we do not follow the Truma Sedeshin. The Vilna Gaon is very much against it. Senishtaka dava v'lo yomar. This should never ever be mentioned. I don't even know why this idea was even conceived. Everybody should just forget whatever happened. There's nothing to talk about here, folks. Everybody go home. That was what the Vilna Gaon have to say about the Truma Sedeshin's idea. But later authorities said, you know what, we're not going to use the Truma Sedeshin's idea with respect to the rental of money, but let's use it with respect to this Iska situation. And that we have an investor that gives the $100 to the manager of the money, and if the money is invested in something which goes bad, typically speaking, the manager of the money who received the funds would not have to return the full $100, he could just return the $50 that constituted the hubba portion. So as the investor can say to the manager, I'm not going to believe you that the investment went bad. Why should I believe you that the investment went bad? You have to bring two witnesses, and the two witnesses should be the rabbi and should be the shliach tzibur. It would be very difficult for you to produce two witnesses that you actually lost money, that the investment actually went bad, and therefore you're not going to get out of repaying me unless you're able to produce these two witnesses that are very unlikely for you to produce. What about in terms of the profit margin, in terms of determining, since the profits are supposed to be shared, you can't really bring witnesses to sit to talk about how much profit was earned or not earned, because the witnesses can simply see whether the money was lost in terms of whether the investment went bad. But in terms of the profits, that's much more speculative. So the later authorities added to the Truma Sedeshin's idea that with respect to the profits, the person who's managing the money would have to make a shavua, would have to take a solemn oath with respect to the amount of the profits. And generally speaking, people are not going to feel comfortable taking an oath, because we know that there's a reluctance in general for us to swear, and the swearing would have to be on a sefer Torah, and it would have to be in front of the entire shul in the middle of davening, and people are going to be reluctant to do that, because who wants to swear even truthfully on a sefer Torah and put themselves in that type of a jeopardy? And therefore, the condition can be, unless you bring the witnesses, and unless you take this oath, the investor says, I'm going to assume that you did make a profit off of the funds, and I will allow you to pay me a certain amount of money, which let's say will be 5% of the entire investment a year. If I give you $100, you'll give me an extra $5 a year, and we'll assume that is the profit that was made, or more accurately, that is half of the profit that was made, that you made $10 profit, and therefore you owe me $5 because we're sharing the profits with each other. And it so turns out that in the event that this investor would have really been a lender, and this manager would have really been a borrower, so then the lender would have charged the borrower 5% a year. So it just ends up conveniently being exactly the same amount. And this is fundamentally how the Hetzer Iska works. And some were skeptical, how can you allow such a thing to go through, which basically assures the lender of the return with ribbis by constructing it or recategorizing it as an Iska transaction. So the answer is twofold. First of all, on a practical perspective, the Torah Tamima of Baruch Levi Epstein, the son of the Aruch HaShulchan, and as we all know, the nephew of the Netziv. The Torah Tamima, we know that because he wrote a book called My Uncle the Netziv. He didn't actually write a book called My Uncle the Netziv. He wrote a book called Mekor Baruch, I think it was, his autobiography, and somebody translated a section of that autobiography into a book called My Uncle the Netziv, where he wrote about his encounters with his uncle the Netziv. So the Torah Tamima also happened to be a banker, so he wrote a lot. He was a very successful banker until he wasn't. So he wrote a lot about banking and banking practices, and he had a lot to say about Hilchos Ribbis, even in his commentary to the Torah, which is well known, the Torah Tamima. So he has various asides in his commentary where he talks about how the prohibition of Ribbis functions from a banking perspective. And he writes, in terms of justifying the contemporary utilization of Heter Iska, he says that it's not all just some sort of a ruse, it's not some sort of a scam of a haroma, as we would say halakhically speaking, because it used to be that people did commerce with objects. They would do commerce with farm tools, with rakes and with shovels and with tractors and with farm tools and things of that variety. And if they would be charging money, they would be charging ribbis in order to acquire their tools and things of that variety. So he said, so that would be ribbis because of the fact that you're not supposed to put somebody in a compromising position because they need money to buy a rake or they need money to buy a shovel. They're doing their business, they're making an agrarian economy. The way in which they are generating their income is through all of the farm tools and all of the farming and so forth. But he said, and what changed in European times is that Jews were not so involved with the land. Often they weren't even allowed to own land. They didn't make their living off of farming and off of farm tools and stuff like that. In fact, some of the European immigrants who came to America settled in South Jersey and South New Jersey, and they tried to make a living as farmers. So some of you have read the book Poor Cousins, and it failed miserably. It wasn't something that we even remember necessarily how to do, even though at one point in time we were very good at farming. Says the Torah Tamima, what is the material with which we do commerce nowadays? It's not farm tools, it's money. That the way in which we make money is through money. So therefore, money really is being used no longer as just a means to buy other things, but it is the form and it is the object of commerce itself. Once it becomes the object of commerce itself, he said, it's not really so far-fetched to say that every single time the money is extended, it's really a business transaction. It's really a joint venture between the person extending the money and the person receiving the money. So that's one explanation. Another part of the equation is that fundamentally, deep down, and this comes up sometimes in Dinei Torah, there is exposure, meaning that in the event that the person who's receiving the funds would actually produce witnesses that demonstrate that that the investment went sour and really would take an oath on a Sefer Torah saying, I didn't earn any profits over here and therefore I don't have to share any kind of a profit dividend with the investor, then in fact the manager of the funds, the recipient of the funds, would be off the hook. And believe it or not, this sometimes really happens, because there is a clause in the Heter Iska that says that a Beis Din will have the right to enforce the Heter Iska, and sometimes a person appears before the Beis Din and says, I lost in the investment. In fact, some of the later poskim, in order to sharpen and in order to improve the force and the strength of the Heter Iska, said, we have a problem. If a borrower, recipient of funds, manager of funds, takes the funds for a very specific purpose. Everybody knows they're going to invest the funds with Bernie Madoff, for example. And then the whole world finds out that everything that was invested with Bernie Madoff went bust. So then, even if there are no witnesses that are produced and there's no shvua that's taken, but Moshe Feinstein has a tshuva, not specifically in the context of Bernie Madoff, which happened after he was nifter, but Moshe Feinstein has a tshuva saying, if the whole world knows that the investment went bad, so then the borrower is really going to be off the hook. But that's only if the borrower makes it clear that the money is being borrowed for the purpose of a very specific investment. If, however, you broaden it, we know that we have a bank that's extending money for a mortgage, for example. So we know that the money is going for purposes of a house. And then if the house goes on fire, or there's a giant hurricane and the house is swept away into the land of Oz or something like that, so the house is no longer around, so then, presumably, even in the context of a Heter Iska, the borrower is not going to, the recipient of the funds is not going to have to pay the profit premium or, you know, pay it back at all, except maybe the 50% that would be viewed as a halva wouldn't have to pay it back at all. So what do you do? What you do is you structure it in such a way that the bank says, I'm extending you this amount of money in return for which I am going to receive a profit margin. I'm going to have a profit share in all of your investments. I don't know what all of your investments are, but the person who receives the funds commits that the person who gave them the money, the investor, is going to have a share in all of their investments. So even if we know that this particular investment went bad, even if we know that the money was invested with Bernie Madoff, because this money was given, it freed up other assets of the borrower recipient to be invested in other things, and therefore this is all part of this joint venture arrangement between the investor of the funds and the recipient of the funds. And if the recipient is not able to demonstrate with witnesses and with an oath that they lost money in all of their investments, so then the lender will still be able to be paid off, will still be able to receive this profit share, which is the amount that the parties agree between themselves will be sufficient as the deemed or anticipated or expected profit share. Now, it still has to be in a reasonable ballpark. If you have a lender who's going to be charging, say, 25% interest, and you're going to have an ISCA transaction, which in order for them to receive half of the profit, you would have to assume that there was at least a 50% profit that was made, that's generally speaking not going to be realistic. So therefore, it has to be some sort of a realistic profit margin. So if it was, for example, a 5% return, you're just assuming a 10% a profit, so that's something which is reasonable. This profit margin is sometimes referred to in the halakhic literature, just for your information, as sakar hispashus. What does sakar hispashus mean? It means that this is the amount of money, which is the hispashus, which is the compromise or settlement amount. The parties have agreed to settle for this amount as the deemed profit margin of the investment. So some of the later poskim said that even though your typical iska, the way it's described in the Gemara, is half of it is a loan and half of it is a pikadon, half of it is for investment purposes, you could also structure the iska in some other fashion as well. What's the alternative fashion in which you could structure the iska? You can structure it as a kulo pikadon. You can structure it in such a way that the malveh is giving all of the money for investment purposes, so that the malveh then has the right, malveh, the investor then has the right to say, I want not half of the profits of the investment, I want all the profits of the investment, because you don't get to keep anything. If half of it was your money, was a halva, a loan, you get to keep half of it. But here, all of it is my money. What's the incentive for the person to, the manager of the funds, to manage funds where they're not going to end up receiving any of the profit, all of it is going to go to the investor. The incentive is that the investor agrees upfront that if the in the event that the manager is not bringing a proof regarding what the amount of the profit was by taking a shvua, by taking an oath, because they don't want to take an oath, so then they'll be satisfied with a mere 5%. And the person who's receiving the funds is thinking to himself, oh, you know what? I can generate 30% of profits from this money. This way I'll be able to keep 25% and I'll only have to give 5% to the investor. And in this day and age, the way in which money is invested, and the fact is the Torah Tamima says that the money is really the main mode of commerce, that might be an attractive deal. And in fact, there are even some poskim who say that in this context, the person who's investing the funds doesn't have to pay this amount of extra money, what we call skar tirka, for the effort of the person, because of the manager. Because you have to pay money for the effort of the manager when the manager is also receiving a loan, and you don't want it to seem like they're putting in the effort only because they're receiving a loan. Here they're not receiving a loan at all. Others say, no, no, since the way that an ISCA is classically structured is that they have to be paid for their efforts, it's going to look a little bit suspicious if they don't get paid for their efforts here. We're going to require a payment for the efforts. So even if it's a kulo pikodon form of heter ISCA, we still require either a dollar payment for the efforts, or that the person who is managing the money will bear a little, will get a little bit more of the profit, or the investor will bear a little bit more of the loss in order to make it 100% legal. So that's basically the way in which a heter iska works. So if we're able to establish that we have a Jewish lender, we have a Jewish borrower, it is possible to restructure the entire transaction as an iska, as a heter iska transaction. And in fact, the 99% of poskim say that this is 100% legitimate lechatchila. The only thing is that there's a mitzvah, the Chofetz Chaim talks about this in his Sefer Avos Chesed, there's a mitzvah that you're supposed to extend money to your fellow Jews as a loan. Because that's considered to be a high form of charity. If I just give outright charity, I give a handout, it can be a little embarrassing for somebody. I give a loan, and the person feels that they have the self-respect that they're obligated to repay it, so that's a high form of charity. As long as it's an interest-free loan, that's a high form of charity. So says the Chofetz Chaim, you'll fulfill a mitzvah by extending an interest-free loan. But don't think that you're fulfilling a mitzvah by giving somebody a loan and requiring ribbis, but saying, oh no, but I'm doing it as a heter iska. So maybe you won't burn in Gehinnom because of the fact that you've restructured it as a heter iska, but it's not going to count as a mitzvah of tzedakah, says the Chofetz Chaim. You want a mitzvah of tzedakah, so you have to just give an interest-free loan without any strings attached, not rearrange it or restructure it as an iska. You restructure it as an iska, so fine, it's mutter, but we certainly would not go so far as to say that this is something which is an outright mitzvah. Okay, fine. So now, getting back to our Quicken Loans story, which I promised you, now that we've given the introduction as to what heter iska is all about, so when it was discovered that this banking institution, this mortgage lender, is a Jewish, is owned primarily by somebody who is Jewish, Mr. Gilbert, so then a number of poskim said, hey, we have a problem here, because a lot of Jews out there who are borrowing money in order to buy houses, mortgage loans, and they're taking it from Quicken Loans. Ah, it's being sold to somebody else shortly thereafter, but that doesn't solve the problem, because generally we have a discussion in the Gemara, when does the Isser of Ribbis take place? So the Isser Ribbis, Losa Simun Alav Neshek, says the Gemara, it takes place at the time of Sima, at the time of Shuma, is the word that's used by the Gemara, the time in which it is established by two parties that it is going to be a Ribbis-bearing loan, that it's going to be an interest-bearing loan. So even if it's subsequently sold, it's by the Jewish lender to a non-Jewish lender before the Ribbis payments are made, it's still going to be a violation at the time of the Ketzisa, the time of the stipulation of the entering into the contract and all of the documents. Furthermore, the loan is eventually going to be paid off because the original or the originator of the loan is going to get paid by the purchaser of the loan. The purchaser of the loan is going to pay all the money in order to pay off the loan on behalf of the borrower. So on behalf of the borrower, we know that the borrower wants this individual to pay off the loan. So this other banking institution is going to pay off the entirety of the amount. It's considered like they are being authorized by the borrower, by the recipient of the funds, here it is the borrower, if I don't have a heter iska, to pay it off on their behalf. And they are paying off in the totality. At the end of the day, they're going to be paying off the entirety of the principal plus whatever interest is owing. So therefore, that itself is going to be a violation of interest. Furthermore, there are poskim who say, and this is already a little bit more in extra credit complicated territory, there are poskim who say that even when the loan is sold off by the Jewish lender to the non-Jewish lender, it's still considered to be fundamentally the loan of the Jewish lender, assuming that the term of the loan has not been shortened and that the person who purchases the loan is purchasing the loan subject to that term, so that if it was a 30-year mortgage loan, the purchaser is stuck, that they can't shorten it to 15 years, they can't say shorten it to 1 week and say we want to be paid off next week. They are bound by the 30-year time period that was set by the original lender, then it's just considered like the original lender is saying to the borrower, instead of paying me beribis, instead of paying me the money, the prohibited interest, pay it to somebody else. And that, the Gemara establishes, is still considered to be a prohibition of interest. When a person who loaned the money says to the borrower, don't pay the interest to me, pay it to somebody else, so that's considered to be, or if it's considered to be, like, I'm getting a benefit that somebody is giving money to somebody I want them to give money to, that's called an indebtedness of Arif, so that is considered to be ribis, that is still considered to be a violation of the prohibition of ribis. Whether that last piece is true is very debatable, because according to the simple understanding that we would all have, without being exposed to this idea, we would say, if a lender A, sells a loan to lender B, so when the borrower is paying the money now, they're not paying the money to lender A, they're paying the money to lender B. But this idea was popularized, actually not popularized, it was written down by the Chavos Das. The Chavos Das of Yaakov Milisa has a commentary on Hilchos Ribis called the Chavos Das, and in his Chavos Das, so he writes that as long as the loan term is still the original loan term, it seems, this is what the words say, the words of the Chavos Das seem to say that this would constitute a ribis-bearing transaction. That's a question, because if you look at some of the other halachos in Shulchan Aruch, and here, you know, I'm going from Minakal El HaKaved, I'm getting a little bit more into advanced territory over here, but if you look at the halachos, the way they're codified in Shulchan Aruch, it seems like that's not really the determining factor necessarily of whether a loan is considered to belong to the first lender or whether it's considered to belong to the second lender. What seems to be a more important determining feature is whether the loan could have been prepaid. If the loan could not have been prepaid, so then we say that the original lender is really still in the picture. It's really still his loan because it couldn't have been prepaid. But if the loan could have been prepaid without penalty, and most mortgage loans nowadays have a clause that says that you can prepay the loan without penalty, without having to pay all of the interest, so then if that could be done, since the borrower could get out of it at any point in time, so then we would say that when the first lender transfers to the second lender, it's considered to be the culmination of the first loan and is only considered to be the second loan at that point in time. So that's possible, but and that's a big raging debate. It's a big raging debate. There were a number of poskim approximately 20 years ago, I don't remember the exact time frame, who raised this issue with respect to all kinds of different Jewish mortgage lenders, because you had Jewish mortgage lenders who were observant, and they did enter into a heter iska in their transactions, but then they would sell the loan immediately afterwards to non-Jewish mortgage lenders who would be the loan purchasers. So what some of the poskim, there's a Rav Lavnuni, said, and Rav Shmuel Gersten, I think I went to high school with him, but he's become a big expert in these dinyanim. I think he's a posek in Lakewood. We went to high school, I think, as freshmen together. In ninth grade, we were in high school together. So, neither here nor there, but a very fine time of Chokham. So, they pointed out that this Chavos Das exists, and because of the fact that the loan term is not being shortened, it's the same loan term, so even when the loan is sold, it's still going to be considered, it's going to be considered to belong to the first lender, and yet when the second lender takes over, the ISCA is going to be extinguished, because no, why would a non-Jewish mortgage lender only take the loan pursuant to an ISCA, to the limitations and to the exposure and possible liability of being subject to an ISCA? So for sure the ISCA is going to go away, and then you just have ribis payments made to this other party. And others say, no, it's not so simple. Since the loan could have been prepaid, therefore when it is sold to the second lender, it's considered like the first lender is completely out of the picture, and the relationship of the borrower at that point in time is only with the second lender, and therefore whatever interest payments they make at that point in time are considered to be permissible. But you still would have the problem if you didn't have the heterisco with the initial mortgage originator, who was a Jewish mortgage originator. You would have the problem at the very beginning that you're entering into ribis ketsutza, you're entering into a ribis bearing transaction in terms of what is being stipulated in the documents. So therefore, there was a clamor saying, because Quicken Loans is primarily owned by a Jewish person, they have to enter into a heter iska in order to allow people to borrow from them, and otherwise people shouldn't borrow from them. So I received probably from 2015 to 2018, I received maybe close to 10 inquiries from people who were negotiating mortgage loans from Quicken Loans saying, can I borrow from them? And I said, well, no, because they're primarily owned by a Jewish lender, unless they agree to do a heter iska. So they were in touch with Quicken Loans, with various representatives of Quicken Loans saying, will you be willing to do a heter iska? And Quicken Loans, the representatives, I have emails here. If you don't believe me, I have actually real life emails from real life representatives from Quicken Loans. They don't have very Jewish sounding names, but they were real life representatives from Quicken Loans. And all of these individuals, Paskin, one of them was named Catherine, for example. So they Paskin, they said, no, don't worry, we don't need a heter iska. And they had a talking point. They actually had talking points which they shared with their loan representatives. Here's a copy of, you know, the talking points, which the representatives would read from the talking points and say, oh, what is a heter iska document? What does a heter iska do? Does Quicken Loans require a heter iska? Because this way, they can relay their psak through their talking points to the people who are borrowing money. They can say, yes, we know all about heter iska. Don't worry, Mr. Goldstein, you don't need a heter iska. Why don't you need a heter iska? A heter iska is not needed when obtaining a mortgage, since Quicken Loans is not owned by a Jew. Okay, that's what they said. It's not owned by a Jew. So I asked them, how can it be that they don't own by a Jew? So they said, because Mr. Gilbert does not hold any shares of Quicken Loans. Who owns them? So what happens then? So how can, is it that he doesn't hold any shares of Quicken Loans? Because Quicken Loans is completely, wholly, 100% owned by Rock Holdings, Inc. And therefore, it's not owned by a Jew, it's owned by Rock Holdings, Inc. But then you have to ask the next question. Who owns Rock Holdings, Inc.? And the answer is, Mr. Gilbert has a 70% ownership interest in Rock Holdings, Inc. Okay, which is, you press them, that's my basic understanding. It's about a 70% ownership interest in Rock Holdings, Inc. So therefore, halakhically speaking, we still have a problem. On another case, so therefore I pointed that out to the representatives. I said, you have a very nice answer, but halakhically that doesn't work for us, and the Jewish borrowers are probably going to rely on their rabbis at the end of the day, rather than these very well-meaning loan representatives with their talking points of Quicken Loans, and therefore you really still do need a heter iska. And what was happening was, the people who were asking rabbis like myself this question, they were dropping out of the process, and, you know, as this became, started to pile up, they started to think a little bit more about, well, maybe this is something that we should consider a little bit more seriously. Another answer that was given in a different email, I won't say which person generated this answer, because maybe I'll be violating, you know, some sort of a trust. I don't know. I don't want to. I want to be careful of being respectful of everybody. But another answer that was given in the communications was, don't worry about it. We're really just servicing the loan because we sell the loan right away afterwards. So they did make that argument. It's not a crazy argument on some level, because as I pointed out, maybe the sale would be a good sale, but there were two problems. One is that the original ketzitza, the original stipulation is a problem. And number two, when you have, as Rabbi Elio Levine of the Lakewood, the head of the Lakewood Choshen Mishpat Kol pointed out, when you have the second institution paying the first institution the full amount owned by the borrower, that's basically Porea Chovos Shel Chavero, the Haskamas Chavero, that you're paying with the consent of the borrower, because then he's going to be on the hook for the, towards the second mortgage bank. It's considered as if the borrower is paying it himself, in which case you really do have a payment of ribis to the first mortgage lender at the end of the day, regardless of how you view the continued ribis payments that are made to the second mortgage lender afterwards. So after a while, what happened was that there were certain poskim who were not as diplomatic as me. I just kind of like emailed with these representatives, talked to them a little bit on the phone, said, you know, you really should do it. I'm going to advise the person not to take the loan. If you don't do it, it's going to end up hurting you. And we would have a nice, respectful, and congenial conversation about it. But if there was a group of poskim that they didn't invite me to sign in the letter, maybe I would have signed it. They invited me, but they didn't invite me. It's okay. So it was a letter that was called the Psak Halacha Meis Gedolia Poskim. It was signed Tesva Shvat Tavshin Ayin Ches, not even one year ago. Signed by Shmuel Kamenetsky, Rav David Feinstein, Rav Shlomo Miller, Rav Moshe Heinemann. Big names, it's okay, good enough names, and including this of Avram Lavnuni, who is the one who identified this other issue of being worried even when the loan gets, a loan with a heter iska gets sold to a non-Jewish mortgage loan purchaser, you could still have a problem. So he signed on this as well, and this was basically a call kolei to the world that said that Mishalovim Ribis B'li Heter Iska Yeshbok Shash Issa Ribis Ketzusa Mehilchos Torah, that is considered to be a Ribis of violation that you have to be seriously concerned about when you borrow money from Quicken Loans, and therefore we're telling people she'asa milchus Torah bikach mashkanta micheva hanal b'li hatarisko, you're not allowed to borrow mortgage loans with ribbis from Quicken Loans altogether. Now, there was another possible out that wasn't really discussed by the poskim. It was alluded to in an article that was written by Rabbi Yair Hoffman, I think is his name, of the Five Towns Jewish Times. He writes halakhic articles, very fine halakhic articles. One could say, I have a way out, because there's a tshuva by Rav Moshe Feinstein. Rav Moshe Feinstein says that banks that are owned by Jews are allowed to borrow money beribis. Not a problem. Even if they're owned by Jews, they can borrow money beribis. They can't loan money beribis to a single Jew, because they're considered Jewish if they're wholly owned by Jews. That's a whole big separate discussion we don't have time to get into today, which is a corporate entity, can a corporate entity be considered to be Jewish or not? So it's generally assumed by Poskim, the first one to identify this issue when it comes to banks was the Kitzur Shulchan Aruch, who said that he considers this to be absolute ribbis, and everyone else after him, even though they were prepared to be lenient if only a minority of the shareholders are Jewish, but if the majority of the shareholders of a bank or any other corporation are considered to be Jewish, so for ribbis purposes, we consider that to be a Jewish entity. They certainly cannot lend to individual Jewish people beribbis. No question about it. But what if they're the borrowers? So Moshe Feinstein said that they could be a borrower. That's okay. Why could they be a borrower? Because in order to be a halakhically prohibited borrower, according to Torah law, in order for it to be ribbis abah milove lamava, what makes a love? What makes a love is that he has personal liability. If he doesn't have personal liability, what we call shibud aguf, he only has a liability for some of his assets, shibud nechasim, but once the assets are exhausted, he doesn't have personal liability. So then Moshe Feinstein says, that's not what ribbis is about. Ribbis is about personal liability. So when you're dealing with a corporation has limited liability. That's the whole definition of a corporation, a ravon mugbal, right? That it has limited liability. So since only the assets of the corporation can be collected from in the event that they owe money, that they assume a debt, and not the assets of the individual owners, not the stockholders, not the investors, that their assets otherwise are not at risk or not in jeopardy, that's only shibud nechasim, and therefore there is no ribbis problem. So Moshe Feinstein actually says something in that very same tshuva, in which he talks about this issue, it's in Chelek Beis of Yoredei, I think it's in Samach Beis. So Moshe Feinstein says something which seems wild. And most people, I don't think, necessarily are focused on it because it's just like thrown in towards the end of the tshuva, and he already said something which was incredibly astonishing beforehand. So if he's going to say something more astonishing, it already lost, you know, some of its teeth or whatever, some of its steam. So at that point in time, but Moshe Feinstein said that, by the way, an individual borrower also could rely upon this. If, let's say, he takes a mortgage loan, and the only asset that the bank would be able to go after is the property itself and not his other personal assets, so that would also be fine. So most people didn't notice that Moshe Feinstein said that. It doesn't seem to really be in consonance with a lot of sugyas in the Gemara that indicate that if a borrower designates what's called an apotekim mefurash, a specific asset, as saying you can that the lender can only collect from this asset, there would still be ribbis problems. So it's difficult to reconcile this tshuva of Moshe Feinstein with that general assumption that emerges from the sugyas in the Gemara, but this is what Moshe Feinstein says. So, technically speaking, if you were relying upon this statement of Moshe Feinstein, maybe because he's saying that the borrower here is really just the asset itself, as opposed to the person, you know, so it's different from the Apotekim Mefurash case, maybe based on that argument, but if somebody could have convinced the Quicken Loans to make to them a non-recourse loan, what does a non-recourse loan mean? Non-recourse loan means that the lender does not have recourse. They do not have the ability to go after all of the assets of the borrower, but only after a specific asset, only after the house itself that's being purchased with the mortgage loan. So then, technically speaking, according to Moshe Feinstein, that might have been another way to get out of the problem. So my understanding is that many of the mortgage loans are not structured as non-recourse loans, and therefore that would not end up being a solution. That's why we have the whole enterprise I was a real estate lawyer at one point in time. We have the whole enterprise of deficiency judgments. What does deficiency judgment mean? It means where the house, the piece of real estate, is not enough to satisfy the loan, and then the lender has the right to go after the other assets of the borrower for a deficiency judgment. So therefore, it would not be a solution in the vast majority of cases, but if you have a very good loan-to-value ratio or something like that, so it might be something that would be considered. Rabbi Hoffman, in his article, said, well, of course this is not going to work. And in fact, the Bris Yehudos, the great famous compilation on Hilchos Ribbis, so when he wrote about this special heter of limited liability corporations, he said, well, of course, if I'm dealing with just a family corporation, like a close corporation, this heter would not be applicable. It's only talking about like a big bank or something like that, but not where it's basically just like a shell corporation for an individual borrower. So it's hard to imagine that most poskim would go along with this extra stretch of Rav Moshe's conceptual analysis. But that also could have been a possibility, as I said, that if you're dealing with recourse loans, so this possibility is completely off the table anyway. Yes?
No, I was just thinking if houses really were, but you're right, they can come after you.
Exactly. Generally speaking, they could, you know, come after. Whether that happens, practically speaking, in most of the cases, I don't know, but technically speaking, they could. Yes?
Does the fact that a person could declare bankruptcy and then get some protection from the court, protection of their assets, mean that to some extent when you do make a loan in modern law, you're investing in the person, because if they do well financially, you get your money back. If they do poorly financially, they can shelter behind the person.
100%. One of the arguments that the Bris Yehuda brings to say why he doesn't think that this argument of a Moshe Feinstein could extend to a non-recourse type of loan or to a close corporation type of situation, it's because he said then everything would be mutter. Because he said in any situation when you're lending money to an individual person, there's always the possibility that maybe they can declare bankruptcy, and there is that risk that maybe you could say it's an investment that basically. So he said that that's just reductive ad absurdum, so he rejected it in part based on that argument. Right. Okay. Now remember, before we get to the end of the hour, in fairness to Quicken Loans, I want to tell the solution to the problem, because at the end of the day, they did the right thing, at least by halacha, they came to an appreciation that, especially when they were reminded by all of these rabbis who sent out this kol kore, a strong admonition to people in the community not to ever borrow money from Quicken Loans. So I think that it all gelled together. Now, I did speak to a rabbi who was very involved. He asked to remain anonymous, so he shall remain anonymous. Who was very involved in negotiating with Quicken Loans a heter iska. And he told me that even though there was this letter was issued by rabbis, the rabbis issue letters all the time of varying degrees of impact. And the letter itself would not necessarily have been all that impactful if not for the fact that there really was this shuttle diplomacy which was going on anyway, discussing with Mr. Gilbert from Quicken Loans the possibility of heter iska. I'd like to think that my emails may have played a role as well. They probably didn't, but you know, every little bit helps, I'm sure. So there were these discussions that were taking place. And eventually, just several months later, the first letter was issued in Shabbat. The next letter was issued in the month of Sivan, okay, several months later, saying, we are so happy to tell you that even though we issued our original letter, now Quicken Loans has actually come to agree. Hineni Odia, we are letting all of Achenu Beis Yisrael know, we're letting all of the Jewish people know, okay? Be'eshi Skimo Cheves Quicken Loans, Lachtom, Ulefasim, Shekol Mashkanta, Velvar, Shibineim, Ubein Lo Beisrael, Me'ayom Mahalahu Altsad, Heter Iska Klali. They have entered into a Heter Iska document. Now, there's an extra word here, the Heter Iska document, and that is the word Klali. What does Klali mean? It means a generalized Heter Iska. You could do Heter Iska in one of two ways. You can sit down with the borrower slash recipient of funds in every single transaction and formulate a stand-alone, customized, tailor-made Heter Iska for that transaction. That's the ideal way to do it, because this way everybody understands that this loan is subject to a Heter Iska. Or you can say, all of my loans that I'm going to extend are going to be included in Heter Iska. And even though the borrower doesn't know about it, you say, well, I'm off the hook because I already made a declaration, like I got up on Erev Rosh Hashanah and I did Hataras Nedarim, and I also said, oh, and by the way, even if I don't say it at the time, all of the loans that I extend are going to be covered by Heter Iska. That's called Heter Iska Klali. Not everybody was so excited about this idea of Heter Iska Klali. It was devised by Rabbi Azriel Eger. So I think a grandson and ainakol of Rabbi Akiva Eger, he came up with this idea. He was the Lublina Rav. And he came up with this idea of a Meir Arik. Certain other people thought, oh, this is wonderful to have this idea of a Heter Iska Klali because it will protect lots of people. Person who was very opposed to it and felt that it didn't really work was none other than Rav Aaron Cutler. Rav Aaron Cutler, Zatzal wrote very strongly against Heter Iska Klali. He said, this is not a nether. A nether is, you're going to take a vow, so that's just something you do for yourself. But here, this is a transaction with somebody else. A transaction with somebody else, you can't just nullify what you're doing with somebody else. And also, here, your actions belie your words. That you're making some sort of representation at the beginning of the year that all of your transactions are going to be according to Heter Iska. But here, the documents say, I'm loaning you money and you have to pay me back interest. So we know what's going on over here. You can't say that the person's initial statement, Kola Osel Das Mishona, who Osel, that it's going to be retroactively attributed to that intention. So a lot of people were not so big on it. You should know that even nowadays, there are poskim who say that it's a good idea. You go to the rabbi for mechiras chametz, one of the things you should say to the rabbi is, oh, you know, I'm going to sell my chametz. Oh, and by the way, I'm also making a declaration to you right now that all of the lands or loans that I'm going to extend are going to be done al sad heter iska. Everything's a heter iska. And if I borrow, everything is going to be heter iska, and therefore I can do anything that I want afterwards. So there are rabbis who promote this because they say it's better than nothing. At least you have Rabbi Israel Eger to rely upon as having accomplished something. And others say, no, we have the objections of Rav Cutler. So all they did was the Heter Iska Klali.
Bank Lumi downtown, he has on the wall there the general Heter Iska when I walked in there.
Right, so what's the problem there? So Rabbi Saul Reisman, who was very big, okay, big promoter, he was involved, I believe, in negotiating this Heter Iska Klali with Rabbi Saul Reisman. We like Rabbi Saul Reisman a lot. We were just talking before the shiur, how much we enjoy listening to his shiurim and so forth. So he wrote an article in the recent Yeshurun journal in which he justified the Heter Iska Klali. He said, this is not your normal Heter Iska Klali. Normal Heter Iska Klali is something that's between the person and their rabbi when they do Mechiras Chametz. This Heter Iska Klali is something which is automatically applicable to everybody because if a bank adopts a Heter Iska Klali, every single time that a person enters into a mortgage loan with a bank, they know that they are taking upon themselves all of the small print that's so microscopic that, you know, they're not even able to read it. And they know that they are borrowing subject to all the bylaws and all the regulations of the bank. And if the bank says that they have this regulation, then whenever it's going to be required, according to Jewish law, everything is going to be converted into an iska. So then they are borrowing explicitly pursuant to that condition. Furthermore, if you look on the Quicken Loans website right now, the Quicken Loans website, actually, you have to click like three or four different things until you get to it. But if you click like the disclaimer section of the Quicken Loans website, you can actually, on your own computer, find the Heter Iska on the Quicken Loans website. They say, oh, by the way, we do our loans when it is necessary, according to Jewish law, according to the principles of Heter Iska. So therefore, said Rabbi Reisman, since they're doing all of these things and they're making it explicit, and even there's even a shiur by Rav Moshe Feinstein that says that even if the borrower doesn't know about it, if the borrower is accepting a loan subject to all of the regulations of the bank, so it's automatic and the borrower doesn't even necessarily have to know about it, there were two tshuvas by Rav Moshe that seem to contradict each other. One tshuva says the borrower needs to know about it. The other tshuva says the borrower doesn't need to know about it. But that one was written later, 4 years later, but it was written later. So therefore, Rabbi Reisman says, this is a super-duper Heter Iska, okay? That therefore, he thinks that even if you don't normally rely upon it, this makes it better. So the rabbis who signed the second letter, according to the Yeshurun Journal, they were of three different mindsets. Some of the mindset that this is lechatchila, to borrow from Quicken Loans subject to Heter Iska is lechatchila, and some held that it is only b'di'evid, something that should only be relied upon b'di'evid. And others said, well, normally it would be b'di'evid to rely upon a Heter Iska Klali, but in this context, what's being publicized on the website and everything else, so they think that this is something which is lechatchila, or at least much better in this case than a Heter Iska Klali would normally be. Now, if you look on the website, you don't have the text of the Heter Iska Klali. I obtained the text of the Heter Iska Klali. Anybody who wants, for my good friend the Dayan, the anonymous Dayan, if anybody wants to see what the text looks like, I will show it to them in camera But I promise to, you know, in general, they just show it to people who ask for it and so forth. So I'm not going to put it on the screen per se, but it is available if anybody would like to see it privately.
Is it a 50-50 or 100%?
It's a 100%. The way it was structured was as a kulo pikodin. It was structured as 100%. It's a very good question, but that's the way that it was structured. And they felt that they would be able to avoid, you know, certain problems by doing it this way. One advantage of the 100% is that it's more realistic to receive the return because you don't have to only receive back one half of the anticipated return, but the investor can receive the entirety of the return. Yes, that is the statement on the website, but that is available to everybody, but it doesn't have the actual text of the Heter Iska, but that is available as well. The bottom line, the only thing that the postman struggled with was what about those people that had already borrowed from Quicken Loans and their loan was already sold. So there was a little bit of room to bidyevid say that you could rely on those postman who say that as long as there was the ability to prepay the loan before it was sold, this really is considered to belong to the second lender as opposed to the first lender. And they said there was no other real solution they could come up with respect to that category of people. So there was an argument that supposedly came from Rav David Feinstein. That was written by, I believe, a Talmid of David Feinstein, wrote it all up in the Yeshurun Journal to say that he felt that one could rely at least b'di'evit on that argument and similar type of arguments. So at the end of the day, it's a happy ending in the sense that Quicken Loans really showed its care and concern for the Jewish law sensitivities of the Jewish community. It's a tremendous testament to this Jewish owner of Quicken Loans that at the end he was prepared to enter into this arrangement. Obviously, nothing is necessarily, you know, 100% perfect in terms of, you know, the way that people would ideally, you know, want things to be done. But the situation here certainly is a lot better than how we started off. And it shows that we shouldn't be embarrassed to express our Jewish law needs to people in the commercial community, that, you know, halacha is strong enough that it's able to present resolutions even to very tricky situations.
Okay. If I'm paying back on a loan and I tell him to make the payments to you, he's my shliach. Do we say ain shliach li dvar aveira? And there any aveira that he's performing ain shliach li dvar aveira?
According to, there's a tshuva of Rashi that says that if I, Reuven, borrows money from Shimon, and instead of taking the money directly from Shimon, he sends Levi to get the money from Reuven and to transfer to Shimon. And then when Shimon repays the money, he uses Levi to repay the money, that there's no problem with this altogether, and everything is fine and dandy. And this is quoted by the Ramah, and virtually everybody says that this is crazy, this is a toast. So the Beis Yosef says it's a toast so fair that it can't be that Rashi really said such a thing. The Taz says, in this context, of course we would say, one of the arguments is, and the Taz says, no, just means that we don't give Miso or Malkus, but there's still an Issa, there's still a prohibition involved. So at the end of the day, we assume that that really is prohibited, but you should know that opinion is out there. However, even that opinion says that if the loan is written in the name of the borrower, when it is dispensed by the lender, even though he dispenses it through a shliach, it's still considered like the borrower is taking it directly from the lender, and that heter wouldn't apply to that type of situation. So therefore, for that reason alone, that approach wouldn't have worked over here.
Thank you. How long a period of time did Quicken